Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Free money for just about everyone. Historic employment numbers rattle markets, and markets are seemingly moving one step forward and one step back. And our guest today, noted author and tax litigation specialist, Dan Pila, will be digging into the CARES Act, all this, and much more on episode number 656 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, and thanks for tuning in this week. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm also the president of investment planning firm Horowitz & Company. And I tell you that because, especially for people who are just tuning in, and we're getting the audience is really growing. And I think that's probably due to the fact that people are really nervous about what's going on with the markets. But I want to tell you that because the topics that we discussed today and the topics and the speakers and the guests and the ideas are what we actually do for real people each and every day. This isn't a podcast where you have hosts that are, and guests, that are talking about the hypothetical, right? I think this could be, people that are not really involved in the business. Because we actually run investment money for people. We deal with clients' financial matters every single day. And we've been doing this for a really long time. I mean, close to 30 years. So what I can tell you is that there's a lot going on involved with people, their emotions, their concerns, and it's reality. A lot of times when markets start getting a little bit weird, you know, selling off, and, you know, it's kind of like, okay, we'll get through this. Maybe it's going to take a little bit longer. Maybe your situation is different than the other person's. Maybe we have to change something. But this particular circumstance is obviously affecting all of us. Now, I can tell you this, that many of the people that I've talked to, whether they're clients or new prospective clients coming in, I've talked to a lot of people in the industry. There's a lot of positive attitude that people are really trying to portray, even though they're working from their homes or maybe not working right now or not knowing if they're going to have a job soon enough. There are a lot of businesses that don't know if they're going to be able to continue. And they're pretty much seemingly at this stage of the game trying to be as positive as possible, seeing that, you know, something's going to break, something will happen in the future, and things are going to be better. But I got to tell you, behind that veneer, there is real fear. People are scared. People are concerned. And who could blame them? I mean, I'm included myself in all this. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns out there right now. I'm walking around and wondering what I'm touching, what I'm doing. Am I going to get sick? Is it going to affect me? Is it going to affect my family? Is it going to affect my clients, my friends, my parents? Constantly worrying and wondering, you know, how is this spread going to calm down? And then, well, what about the businesses that are out there? What's going to happen to my local haircuttery? What's going to happen to the local businesses that I frequent? How are things going to happen, you know, go with the markets long term if we're seeing historic unemployment levels like we're seeing here, where we have a total of 10 million of new initial claims over the last 2 weeks. An unemployment rate, as we calculate it right now, at this instance, with the information that we had over the last 2 weeks from the initial claims, at about 8.8%, probably going up somewhere in the vicinity of, I would say, to 15 or 20%, albeit possibly temporary. But there's going to be a long tail that we have to deal with from this whole virus. Because this event, this virus, it's an event. And what it's doing is it's attacking us from pretty much every side. And no one, I don't think anybody, maybe there's somebody, but I don't think anybody's really immune to any of the aspects of this, whether it's, well, I know maybe I'm sick or I know somebody's sick, or possibly it's an issue for someone in my family in terms of not just the illness, but the implications of business. And if that is all okay, you're healthy, you're not worried about your business, you're still confined to your house or at least a vicinity. And if even if you're not confined because your state doesn't impose that or your county doesn't impose that, a lot of businesses are closed. You can't do or be what you used to be. You can't just say, hey, let's go out to that place for dinner or that bar, or let's go bowling. Let's go to the movie theater. Just not happening. That's a big problem. And that's scarring. So what I wanted to do in this particular episode, we could talk about the markets. We do that on DH Unplugged every Monday and Wednesday right now at 4:30 in the afternoon. We're hosting a pop-up webinar. That link is over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So if you want to do that, it's all about Q&A. We open it up with a couple of comments about what's going on right now, the latest updates, and then it's open to Q&A. In the last couple of weeks, we went on for about 45 minutes or so with just listener questions, people just asking whatever they wanted to ask. There's nothing that's off limits. So if you want to participate in that, definitely do it. Monday and Wednesdays, sign up for it. You'll get a reminder about it. But what I wanted to do on this episode in particular was to talk about the government lifelines that are out there for businesses and for both individuals. And I think there's a lot of confusion about this $2 trillion and who gets what and what kind of benefits can I get if I'm a business? What about as an individual? When do I have to file my taxes? When do I have to take my required minimum distributions? So I want to dig into this, and I wanted to really focus in on the key areas that I think may benefit you, or at least you should know about. So without further ado, let's get right to our guest and dig into this whole situation regarding the CARES Act. And our guest today is Dan Pilla, who's a tax litigation specialist, and he is the author of How to Win Your Tax Audit and the just-released Small Business Tax Guide. And Dan was with us sometime, I think it was January of 2019. We were talking about the taxpayer rights. But today, we're really going to cover the area of the CARES Act. You know, we're talking about $2 trillion or so, a couple of zeros on either side of this. And we really need to get down and dirty on this because there's a lot in this bill. Dan, you're going to guide us through this, right?
Well, I'm going to do my best, Andrew, for sure. There's a lot to the bill. As you well know, it's about 800 pages long. And as you said, $2+ trillion. So there's a lot there for sure.
So we have what's called the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which is CARES. We have to have an acronym for all this, right? Isn't that always the case? Got to have an acronym.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not sure when that started. You know, it was probably around the mid 1980s they started putting acronyms on all this stuff.
I wonder if there's like someone hired specially to do just acronyms. Like there's there's headline writers for like newspapers, right? And what's your job? I come up with the acronyms for all the tax code.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about this. There's two components to this, as I see it. We could split it up into individuals, and we could split it up into businesses. Right? There's two parts of this. So right, let's talk about individuals first. So the first thing that came out that was really, you know, everybody was excited about was the whole idea of these stimulus checks, $1,200 approximately, depending on income and all that, but we'll talk about that, for each individual, and $500 for each kid. So each family can have what? That's $3,400 total per family.
The $500, Andrew, is based on every child under 17 years of age. All right, so if you've got five kids plus husband and wife, you know, five times five is 2,500 plus 2,400. That would be what? That's $5,900. So there's no limit on the $500 component to this
thing. I thought there was a limit of just two kids, but okay, that's good.
No, that's
good to know. Well, I guess me and my 34 kids are gonna check in for that. You know, but
absolutely.
When are these gonna come? Because there's some concern about, you know, if you filed the tax return and you got a refund in the past and you had a direct deposit into your bank account, Secretary Mnuchin says 2 weeks. It'll be about 2 weeks. But if you don't
have... That,
I mean, how does this work?
Well, you're just about right there. As far as the IRS is concerned, they're going to base these refunds on 2019 tax returns if they're filed, or 2018 tax returns if they're not filed. Now, there's been a lot of mixed messages coming from the Treasury Department. First, they told us that there had to be a return filed for 2018 or 2019 to base the refunds on. Well, Andrew, there's millions of senior citizens across the country that aren't required to file tax returns. Mm. All right, so what are they supposed to do? Well, the first thing the Treasury told us is, well, you got to file returns just so we have the information. Well, now they've reversed that. So if you're not required to file a return because you're on Social Security or you're on veterans benefits or railroad retirement or any of these programs that are paid by the government, they already know what your income is and they already know what your bank account information is. And so they're going to send that out. Now, they're talking, right, the latest news I got yesterday is that they're talking about 3 weeks here to start issuing these refunds. Now, if you haven't filed a 2018 tax return or 2019 and you're required to do so, you're a wage earner, self-employed person or whatever, you're not going to get your benefit, your stimulus check, unless you get that return filed. And so even though we're on extension now from April 15th to July 15th to file tax returns for 2019, of course, that extension doesn't apply to 2018. So if you're delinquent for your 2018 return, my best advice is get it filed as quickly as you can so they can base the stimulus check off that return.
So what happens if for whatever reason, you've never had a refund, so you don't have a bank account on, well, it's two things. You don't have a bank account on record. And what happens if, since last year when you did file, if you got your refund and it went direct deposit at your bank account, but you've changed banks since then?
Well, the Treasury tells us, and again, this is a report we got yesterday, is that they're going to be setting up a portal on their website in the next week or so to allow people to go in and issue, or not issue, but to go in and record their bank account information on a Treasury website. This is going to be some sort of a secured website, and that's where the information will go. Now, short of that, Andrew, if there's no bank account information on file, and yet the IRS has a last known address for you, then they'll mail a check. All right. Now, here's the thing. The last known address is legally defined as the address on your most recently filed tax return. So here's another word of caution for folks who haven't filed returns recently. If the last tax return you filed, let's say, was 2017, and you've moved twice since then, then you better do one of two things. Number one is file that correct tax return for 2018 and 2019. Get them filed. Number two, I recommend that you submit to the IRS a change of address form. All right. This is something people never think of when they move. But if you file a change of address form, it's IRS form 8822-8822. That notifies the IRS of your most current address, and they have to mail documents, checks, et cetera, to your last known address. That is important for folks that have been on the move here recently.
So we'll put that, we'll put a link on the show notes for this episode so that people that did move and wants to find that form, you can look it up, of course, through Google or whatever, but we'll put a link to that form on episode number 656 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's really good information. So you said that Social Security recipients will also not have to worry if they didn't file a tax return, or other people who are in the system, in the federal retirement system, but didn't file a return, they'll be okay because they're automatically in the system already.
Right, right.
Now, what are the limitations on how much money you can get? Who can get money and who can't in terms of income?
Okay, here's what the cap is. If you're a single person with adjusted gross income under $75,000, you'll get the full $1,200 check.
Mm-hmm.
If you're married filing jointly, income up to $150,000, this is adjusted gross income now, up to $150,000, you'll get the check. If you're a head of household, I believe the number is $112,500 of adjusted gross income. That you'll get the full $1,200 check. After that, Andrew, once your income exceeds those amounts based on your filing status, then the check phases out. All right, doesn't shut off like a light switch. It phases out to the point where once you're a single person with more than $99,000 of income, you don't get anything. Married filing jointly more than $198,000, you don't get anything.
You know what's interesting about that is I'm just thinking about this just now. The person who made $75,000 this year versus the person that made, let's say, $150,000 this year or last year. Let's say in 2019, one person makes $75,000, one person makes $150,000. Both of them are unemployed. Why should one get less than the other?
Well, this is the dirty little secret of the tax code, Andrew. You know, we've got an entire leftist philosophy out there that continues to pound on the idea that rich people pay no taxes, that all the tax breaks, that all the breaks in the tax code go to rich people, and that rich people can use these loopholes and strategies and hidden techniques that no one knows about to reduce their taxes to zero because the little guy can't use all these hidden loopholes and strategies. And it's all just 100% total unadulterated nonsense. Mm. All right. The fact of the matter is that every element of the tax code is weighted in favor of low income people, not high income people, starting at the very foundation of the tax code, which is the graduated income tax rates. The more you make, the greater percentage of income you pay. Mm-hmm. All right. The lowest rate is 10%. The highest rate is 37%. The more you make, the greater percentage of your income you pay. So it's just pure nonsense that the tax code favors the rich. Every element of the code favors low income people. And this is just one example of it.
So, yeah, because I don't understand it. You know, it seemed like almost in a bizarre way, the person who was making more money that was let go would require more money for their lifestyle. You know, I mean, I know that's a kind of perverse, weird thinking on this. And that would never really.
But the fact of the matter is, and this is just a sad reality in America, and that is, you know, the more income people make, the more money they make, the more they spend.
Right.
You know, and you're in the investment world, you know this better than I do, but I see it across the board with clients, you know, and I've been doing this litigation work for over 40 years, and I've had clients that have been in every single walk of life you can imagine, and I'm telling you, it just doesn't seem to make any difference how much money people make. They spend it all.
Well, and that's the problem with where we are now, right? Whereas, you know, our savings rate has been so low for so long on an individual basis, as well as the corporate world, because it was shunned.
Yep.
The savings
yep.
and putting away money and holding back and having a clean balance sheet with just an incredible amount of cash on hand for whatever they want to do was shunned for years. And now we get into a situation where we have a sudden stop on the economy and nobody, listen, this is beyond anybody's expectation to be prepared for. I got it. But if we were a saving economy, we would have had a little bit of money to kind of do some other things with.
Look, Andrew, as long as I've been an adult, in fact, I started learning this stuff when I was in high school as a kid, the financial stuff. And I remember learning, you know, when I was 18 or 19 years old, maybe 20 years old, that it is sound policy to have at least 6 months worth of your necessary living expenses stashed in cash in savings so that if something happens, you can at least survive a short-term hiccup without getting yourself into a crisis. What we see now, Andrew, what's been going on, and again, it's virtually across the board, if the typical American family got a flat tire,
yeah.
it would be a financial crisis
right.
because they've got zero money saved
yeah.
and most of their credit cards are maxed out.
Well, that's what we live on. It's not really, so that's what we live on. We live on credit. That's really the problem, isn't it? That we don't care about having.
Yes,
we don't
exactly
care
right.
about having a safety net. We don't care about an emergency fund because, well, what the hell? We got credit. I've talked to several people.
In this context, the federal government is a teacher.
Yeah.
You know, since post-World War II into the 1950s, the federal government's been running deficit after deficit, and it gets worse and worse. And you know, here we've got, $2 trillion worth of national debt on the books. Lord only knows what it is off the books, and the federal government just continues to send this message to the public that debt doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If you've got a problem with debt, just borrow more money. That's all.
That's nuts. Let's go on to some other things that are involved for individuals. For example, RMDs, required minimum distributions on IRAs. They were recently in the last tax bill pushed to 72 years old as the minimum age requirement to start taking it as long as you are below 70 and a half when 2020 started. But what's happening in this bill with regard to required minimum distributions for people that are over the age of 70 and a half or 72?
Yeah, well, what's happened is the minimum distribution rules are completely waived for 2020. All right, so you don't have to take a nickel's worth of your minimum distribution this year. Now, starting next year, of course, in 2021, then, of course, you're going to have to start doing that again. But where we're at right now is just a hold on minimum distribution. So the good news is, well, it's good news and bad news. The bad news is your 401k and IRA probably took a pounding, unless for some reason you moved into cash sometime or, you know, late January. But the good news is you don't have to take that money out now. You can leave it sit there at least for the rest of 2020, and hopefully, and Andrew, this is my question for you, what do you see as the potential for recovery here, whether it's slow recovery or fast recovery? I'd like to get your view on what you think that's going to look like.
So I think there's a lot of little things that are going into this, and my listeners have heard me talk a little bit about this, but basically, you know, there's this question, are we going to have a V recovery where it's like, you know, lights on, lights off, lights back on again? Or is it going to be more of a U recovery, which is a slow kind of, slog to get higher? And then the other one, which we kind of bring around sometime, is like a square root, right? Where we get this big drop and then we get it move up and a little bit of V, and then it flattens out a little bit. So I think from a market perspective, it's going to be all about how long this goes on with regard to our stay-at-home policies. And even after that, this PTSD that's going to develop and people not wanting to go into crowded places, possibly not want to necessarily go to work, not want to travel on mass transit. There's a lot of, I think, scarring that's going to happen just being contained for a week now. I'm like, I'm telling you, I told everybody, I feel like I'm Howie Mandel. I mean, I won't touch anything. You know, I don't touch me. I go places like I got the, you know, when the mail comes in, I look at it with either a paper towel I put around it or something to see what's going on. I don't want to be, this is pretty scary stuff, right? So,
well, it's very scary stuff. And let me tell you what, I mean, this is just my opinion now. Now, I'm not an investment professional. I'm a tax guy. But the way I see it is because of the cause of the problem, which was virtually an overnight economic crisis. I liken it, Andrew, to holding a basketball underwater. You can forcibly hold a basketball underwater, but it wants to reach its equilibrium on its own without any force. So the minute you take your hand off that basketball, and I don't care how far you've pushed it down into the water, the minute you take your hand off it, it immediately shoots to the top. And I think as soon as, this is just me talking now, I don't have any evidence to show this, But what I think is as soon as these restrictions are gone, I think it's almost business as usual overnight. Now, there's going to be repercussions, no question about that. You put your finger on a number of them, this so-called PTSD, that's a good way to put it. But the fact of the matter is people want to bust out right now.
Yeah.
And once these restrictions are off, that's what they're going to do.
But I think it's going to take a different form than it had before initially. Like, for example, maybe you'll meet with friends, maybe you'll do some stuff, but maybe you're not going to go to a movie theater right away with people you don't know, right? Because a trust factor is kind of there. And are you going to be necessarily traveling on a cruise line? Are you going to be on a plane and going somewhere else? So I think you may have a lot of people like going to Mount Rushmore for their summer vacation rather than going to Italy, as an example.
Sure.
The other question is, though, with regard to the amount of upward action that you can have, I think that your basketball lost some air when it was underwater. And it depends on how long it's been spending underwater. If it's just very quick, I agree with you. You know, if it's an on-off. But if this does last beyond April 30th, May 15th, May 30th, I think there's going to be some permanent damage that's done. That's the only thing that I'm concerned about. Now, at the same time, I do agree with you that there is a lot of pent-up demand, and that could, you know, spring up inflation and issues about that, okay, we'll deal with that when that time comes. But at the same time, people want to go back to work. They want to be there. But I'm just saying that I think it's going to be a cautious bounce up with a little bit of
I can see your point. And as a matter of fact, the inflationary factors, Andrew, are an issue as well. But don't you agree that those are already introduced into the marketplace here with this 2.2 or whatever it is? Let's call it $2 trillion. Yeah. And Andrew, all they're doing is printing the money for that. Right. They're just printing the money.
I totally agree, because we also have a supply shock right now, where at the time, if we don't have factories that are manufacturing things and all that, their inventories are getting really low. And if when if it does, in fact, rebound initially, what's going to happen is that prices are just going to go up because demand's going to come out of nowhere. So right now we have a deflation demand shock and a supply shock that's going to release into inflation. Add to that the $2 trillion that's being introduced here, you know, because like you said, there's some companies that are able to get this free money. We'll get to that in a second, but can get free money. So people, whether it's, for example, the $600 that they can get from the federal level of unemployment, if they can get it, they could basically right now not even go back to work and still earn $600 per week. That's pretty good for some people. Right. Not everybody, but some people.
Well, yes, for some people.
So there's going to be kind of, some demand destruction due to the fact that there are some businesses that won't be able to survive. So I think I like your analogy, but I do think that basketball is going to be a little less inflated than it would have been in other circumstances. But let's go on. There's also some things
only
with
time will tell.
Yep, 401k loans. 401k loans, you're able to actually take a larger amount from your 401k now. Is that a good idea?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. You're right. They pushed it. They pushed the limit from $50,000 up to $100,000 on loans from retirement plans, not just a 401k or a 403b for that matter. They can take up to $100,000. And the question is whether that's a good idea. Well, that depends on the facts and circumstances of the case. If you take the loan and you don't pay it back, then what happens is the tax law considers that loan to be a distribution effective the day that that the loan itself is forgiven. So let's say you take the $100,000 and you get yourself involved in a loan, and it turns out, you know, to your point, Andrew, earlier, it turns out that you're not going back to your job, even though they've released all the restrictions. Maybe your job just isn't there in the same form it was in January. And so now you can't pay back the loan. And so you negotiate with your 401k administrator, your plan administrator, and the loan is forgiven. Well, now at that point in time, it's considered a distribution.
Right.
So now you've got $100,000 worth of income, or less whatever you've paid back, that has to be recognized as income on your tax return. So, whether it's a good move or a bad move is ultimately, unfortunately, judged in hindsight.
Yeah. I think also there is a new rule that you could take an IRA distribution prior to age 59 and a half, and the penalty is waived, although the ordinary income is going to be taxed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a whole list now of reasons you can take a 401k or IRA distribution without the 10% penalty, but under no circumstances is that not considered income.
Right.
So if you take $50,000, let's say you're a 40-year-old person, you take $50,000 out of your IRA, you're not going to pay the 10% penalty if you fall into one of these factors, but the income, the 50 grand, still is income on your tax return. All right, so you can take the distribution, Andrew, if you have been diagnosed with either SARS or COVID, or your spouse or a dependent was diagnosed, or if you've experienced financial hardship because of quarantine or other factors. All right, so these are basically the things that come into play here for taking the money without the penalty. But again, we got to emphasize here, and I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people who've taken IRA distributions that said, "Well, I didn't know it was I had to count it as income." Well, you know, you need to know this stuff. It is income, even if you don't owe the 10% penalty.
What about Roth? Is there any kind of ability to waive, like, the five-year rule for the Roth or anything like that? Is that all those?
I've not seen anything in the bill that addresses Roth, because if you've had the money in the Roth for 5 years, you take it out tax-free anyway.
Right. Yeah. Anything else for individuals that you could think of?
Well, let's see here. We've got the medical expenses now. The IRS has, or the CARES Act. I couldn't spit it out. The CARES Act has now allowed for additional medical expenses to be claimed by people who don't who don't itemize their tax, their itemize their deductions on their tax return. So in other words, in order to get medical expenses, typically, Andrew, you have to file a Schedule A and itemize your deductions. And now there is a, it's not much, but it's something. It's a $300 deduction that's allowed for anybody, whether you itemize your deductions or not. So that's
a little help.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, it's something. It's Look, the way the federal government has addressed the deduction of medical expenses, for 30 years, as far as I'm concerned, has been a debacle. But, you know, the other thing is charitable contribution deductions. Now, charitable contribution deductions are available. You know, there was a limitation of 50% of adjusted gross income. That's gone up to 60% of adjusted gross income, I believe, is the number. And so you're allowed to give a larger portion of your adjusted gross income to charity and still get a deduction for it.
I think student loans also, is that something where you're away from paying the interest with, and it's being pushed back or away from your payments for a while?
You know what, Andrew, you could be right about that, but I haven't seen anything on student loans specifically.
I thought there was something there. Well, let's skip over to businesses.
You could be right.
Let's skip over to businesses for a second. There's first, there's the SBA, the Small Business Association, that's working with the Treasury.
Well, let's do this, Andrew. I don't want to tell you how to do an interview, but if you don't mind, I really want to hit on something that's important for businesses.
Okay.
Before we get into the loan thing.
All right, you go for it, man.
The IRS gave us an extension from April 15th to July 15th on the filing of the tax returns, all right? So we know that. We know that the income tax payments are also extended to July 15th, but there's an important benefit here for small businesses with respect to the employees' trust fund taxes, the employment taxes that you owe on your employees, all right? That has been not forgiven, but it's been delayed until the end of 2020. So if you can't pay the employment tax liability on your employees, that liability is extended, or the payment due date is extended to the end of 2020. Now, that doesn't, Andrew, mean that you don't have to deposit the withheld taxes.
Right, yeah, of course. You still have to deposit the withheld taxes from
your employers. Yeah. But the matching Social Security and the unemployment tax, you can defer that until the end of 2020, and then there's a payment term that's available where you have to pay 50% of it in 2021, and then the balance of it has to be paid by 2022. So that's going to help some small businesses here that are being crunched, by the cash flow crisis that we're dealing with here.
Speaking about, just to go wind this back a second, to the deficit that we've built, the lack of taxable income coming in from all of this is going to really throw the budget more out of whack than ever. Don't you think?
Oh yeah, no question about it. And then frankly, that's something that's not getting discussed here. We're talking about these checks, $1,200 checks that are supposedly going to save the world. But what's all of this going to do to the budget deficit when the amount of tax liability that's being collected by tax revenue, I should say, is being collected during this period of time? It's, you know, who knows what that's going to look like.
Yeah, crazy. All right, since we went through that, we're going to move on to businesses?
Sure.
Okay. So I think that's really important too. But by the way, that does give a lot of, that does alleviate a lot of the problems for people, because they get at least time, right? You know, some time to get things in order. So the SBA is charged with the responsibility to work with the Treasury to get all this stuff done, also involving specific banks that work with the SBA, and it's going to be backed and guaranteed and all these different plans. Well, first thing is, there's a $10,000 disaster relief loan that's available from the SBA. I think it's about $10 billion, I think it is. If you calculate it out, it's about the first million businesses that apply that are supposed to be able to get this. It was a first-come, first-served basis. And the interesting thing about some of these things with businesses is that these loans, under certain circumstances, are forgivable, right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Well, we can start with the SBA loan. It's a so-called economic injury disaster loan. These are loans that are administered specifically by the SBA, and they put, I believe the number was $350 billion total into the SBA fund to fund these loans. Now, part of these loans, Andrew, as you accurately said, is a $10,000 grant, not a loan, but a grant to the first X number of businesses that apply, and that, of course, as a grant, doesn't have to be paid back. Now, as far as the loans themselves are concerned, the SBA, you make your application through the SBA, and then there's a determination as to how much you get. And what those are is low interest loans that can be set at fixed rates over 30 years. So that's as I said, the so-called economic injury disaster loan, and those are applied for directly through the SBA off their website.
Then there's another one called the PPP, which is the Payroll Protection Program.
Right, Payroll Protection Program, and that's a different program mm-hmm. altogether. The SBA loan, the typical SBA economic injury loan, can be used to fund anything, all right? You can use that money for anything. I suppose you could buy gold with it and bury it in a hole if you wanted to. I'm not exactly sure, but you can do anything with the money. These Paycheck Protection Program loans are completely different, all right? Those loans are limited in amounts, and they're fully forgivable. This is the remarkable trait of these loans is they're fully forgivable, but they can only be used for a narrow window of expenses. They have to be used to pay your payroll for your employees, or to pay for inventory items for your business, or to pay mortgage payments or rent payments on business property. So it's got to fall into one of those four categories. If you use the money for those items, the loan can be forgiven. But even if it's not forgiven, Andrew, this is remarkable, because even if it's not forgiven, the loan is unsecured and by law is defined as non-recourse. So if you don't if you don't pay it, even if it doesn't quote-unquote get forgiven, the government can't sue you for the money.
Unbelievable. Now, what's interesting is
it's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And not only that, when it's forgiven, it's not taxable.
That's exactly right. If they do forgive the loan through formal processes, you don't have to claim the debt forgiveness as income, which under normal circumstances it could be.
So here's the thing. So my understanding of this is that it's 2 times your average salary or your payroll over the last year. There's a date range on a monthly basis. So you could take 2 months.
Well, wait a minute now. It's 2.5 months, Andrew. 2.5 months.
Yeah, 2.5 times your monthly average payroll. So same thing. 2.5 times, if I didn't say it right, forgive me, but 2.5 times your monthly average payroll over, let's call it 2019. So let's say that your monthly average payroll, and there's a limitation that anybody that earns over $100,000 is in gross salary. You can't use that as part of it. So you got to cut it off at $100,000. So
you got to cut it off at $100,000. You can use it up to $100,000.
Right. So let's say that you have some business that has a couple of employees and an owner, and they're doing their thing, and the salaries come out to be $10,000 per month. That's the average.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
So you take that, you multiply by 2.5, so you get $25,000.
Correct.
Then you fill out a form with a bank if the bank does cooperate with you and it works. And supposedly it's a pretty easy process. You have to supply them with a bunch of information and 941 forms, and you have to provide them with some other things and blah, blah, blah. And then it's supposed to be pretty fast. And then when you get your money, you have 8 weeks, from my understanding, is that right? 8 weeks?
I believe it's 12 weeks.
Okay.
I believe it's 12 weeks.
Okay. It's between 8 and 12 weeks then, somewhere around there. But yep. I'll take your word for it. You have that period of time to utilize that money for salaries, but you couldn't have fired anybody, right? Isn't that the issue? You can't fire anybody?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. You got to keep your employees on payroll. That's the whole idea.
Right.
Paycheck protection. That is to say, I'm not going to turn my employees loose. I'm going to keep paying my employees. I'm going to use the government money to do it with. Yes.
Right.
You're exactly right.
And you can pay for rent and a few other things. It's a pretty good deal if you think about it, especially for a business that, was thinking about, oh, how am I going to last through this? I don't want my people to go, but there's a lot of questions about this. Like, banks weren't even ready to get this rolling on Friday. And then there was also the question about, okay, well, do I do that? Or do I let the people just get their $600 a week from unemployment? Because they're going to get that for a lot longer period and I don't have to worry about it. What if I furloughed employees for a period of time? Does that count as firing them? Do I have to hire them back right now? It's like a lot of weird things. It looks like it wasn't quite ready to go out as planned.
You're exactly right. There's 100 questions on all of this stuff. Now, one other element that I want to throw into the mix here, Andrew, and that is the cap on the loans. The cap on the loans is $10 million, which is pretty high. So if you've got 30 or 40 employees instead of 4 or 5, your payroll's not 10 grand a month, it's 60 grand a month or 100 grand a month. You know, you've got up to $10 million that's available on these loans here. So it's a pretty significant chunk of money. And I think that businesses should look at this because, as I said, there are four categories of places you can put the money, not just in payroll, but for mortgage payments, for rent payments, for inventory. And as you well know, Andrew, money's fungible. So, even if you've got some cash available and you've got, as a business, a war chest to get you through a storm here for a period of time, if you went and got that loan and used it to pay for your payroll and then took the money that would be otherwise earmarked for payroll and use that for, marketing or whatever during this period of time, you would certainly be on better footing, no question about it.
So how long let's take that scenario that I played out for you, where you have $10,000, so we're going to get $25,000 of qualifying potential expenses, right? But I say, you know what? I want another $100,000. Because I don't know what you're going to do. You're going to hire another person. You think it's a good time for your business when it comes back that you're really going to take some market share. Okay. That other $100,000, which does not qualify for forgiveness. How long do you have to
pay? You're talking about the SBA part now.
What's that?
You're talking about the SBA part.
Yeah, because it's one package, right?
Well, it'd be two different packages. The Paycheck Protection Program. This is as I understand it now, Andrew. You understand? Okay. I'm willing to be wrong about this, but everything that I've read here in the last week indicates to me that we're talking about two different packages.
Okay, gotcha.
The Paycheck Protection Program is one loan that's based on payroll, period.
I gotcha.
All right, so it's 2.5 times your monthly payroll average for the 12 months preceding January the 1st of 2020. So basically, you're looking at your 2019 payroll average per month times 2.5. That's what you get.
Gotcha.
And that's limited to those four categories that I talked about.
Right.
If you pay the money, if you use the money for those four categories, one or all of those categories, one or more, I should say, then it's forgivable. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about paying it back.
Got it.
The small business loan, that would be the economic injury disaster loan, that is subject to repayment terms and conditions set up by the SBA.
And what's the interest rate on that? That's not the 1%.
Say again.
The PPP, if you don't use it for those qualifying events, is a 1% repayment on a short-term loan.
That's my understanding, yes.
And the SBA has another set of interest rates for other loans.
Yeah, the SBA loan, I understand, is at 3%.
Right, which is still pretty cheap.
It's still pretty cheap,
exactly. What other things? Are there any other tax credits? I heard there were some tax credits for certain health care or some other kind of...
Well, there's some payroll tax credits in this bill as well. So to the extent that you continue to make your payroll credit... or to make your payroll, what happens is that you get a refundable credit. So that is to say it goes below zero, you can actually get a refund, right?
Mm-hmm.
Refundable quarterly payroll tax credit. It's up to 50% of the wages paid to an employee. And so for purposes of the credit, it's up to $10,000 of wages per employee is taken into account. So you can get this credit where, credits pay your taxes for you, right? That's what they do.
Right.
And so this is frankly a big deal as well. So it's that 50% payroll credit
that's going to be on next year's tax return. Right, you'll get it on the back end.
These are employment tax returns.
Right.
Now, so right, these are payroll tax credits. So they're going to be on quarterly returns. The form 941 going forward is my understanding of where that's showing up.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love that.
Yeah, so let's take a look at this now. So on the one hand, you get the payroll protection loan, and let's just say, using your example, you got 25 grand, and on the other hand, you get a 50% refundable credit. Between the credits and the loan, you might be getting $35,000-$40,000 in economic value here that is straight to your bottom line.
Ugh, something. I mean, it is pretty amazing. Now, the only thing is, we hope we can get this out to the people because, again, I've gone through with some other people, some clients. We've done a few things. For example, last week went on the unemployment to help them fill out their unemployment forms. Nothing yet. Not a piece of email. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. Help people with the $10,000 SBA direct grant. Not an email from them. Not a peep. I even heard, by the way, today I was reading an article that even if you filed previously, you need to refile again. They'll give you an advance. And if you don't qualify, it's still going to be a grant. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I'm looking for some numbers right now. It's going to take me just a second. I got them right now. This isn't it. Just bear with me 1 second. Just 1 second.
All right. Gotcha.
What the IRS is going to spend on marketing, Andrew. This is with respect to the $1,200 checks here now. Okay, and so they've got money that was put in their budget to promote to the public these checks. All right, and here's what it is. They've got $2.93 million for IRS taxpayer services to support this, and then they've got another $170 million for IRS operations specifically to tell people about this $1,200 payment that they're entitled to. So the IRS is going to spend as much money on marketing this $1,200 check as was spent on the doggone Super Bowl in advertising.
Don't you think that Andrew Chang should be the spokesman for this whole thing? Why not put him in charge? This was his concept to begin with that nobody really cared about. Give everybody $1,000 a month. Put him in charge of this.
$1,000 a month. I mean, that's the only difference is it's $1,200 instead of $1,000 a month.
Yeah, but you give him 600. You're giving him 600.
Well, yeah, you're right with the unemployment, but that you're right. I mean, this is what's frustrating about this stuff, and this is, you know, people need help, no question about that. This is unforeseen. It's nobody's, you know, certainly no bar owner, no restaurant owner is at fault for this. I get all that, but my heavens, at what point do you say that the cure is going to kill the patient? I mean,
well, that's a good point.
We can't kill our economy in the process of trying to save the economy.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I totally agree with you. And then you have a lot of moral questions involved with this. I totally get it. You have to wonder if you did lift it and you said, okay, you know what, just do your thing. If people would actually do their thing, you know, especially if you get a $600 paycheck where you may have been making $600 before, but now you get both $600 plus you get your $250 or whatever it is from states. You're like, well, I'm getting $800 a month. What's the difference here? So I don't know if that's really going to help, especially in things like manufacturing where it's, you know, you may be able to get another job at another place. You know, your skill set is there. But, you know, we're going to see an unemployment rate that's right now, by my calculations at this present time, actually, as of the mid of this week, my calculations at the present time, we're at 8.8% unemployment right now. Now, that doesn't take into consideration anybody that's filed this week forward. So if we get another 5 million next week that are filing for unemployment, you know, that's going to take it back up to about 11.5%, 12% right there.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, this is going to be...
Well, I've seen numbers from the Wall Street Journal that project, depending on how long this goes out, you know, if it's going into June, we're talking about 50 million unemployed people.
Yeah.
Andrew, that's just staggering.
That's
staggering. And then I'm not sure that my basketball theory has any merit to it. If we're talking about 50 million unemployed people over the next four or five months, that's I don't know about that.
The depression level was 24 and change, just over 24% unemployment rate back then. Now it's a different economy, it's a different thing, it was less people, it was, you know, there's a whole different thing going on there. But that was
here's the other dynamic, frankly, that I think mitigates that. And that is, how many more businesses are going to be spawned during this period of time by people who didn't think that they could do anything except go punch a clock, but now they realize that there's all kinds of things they can do remotely in their own small businesses. I mean, we saw this in spades, Andrew, during the latter part of the 1980s with all that corporate downsizing that was going on during that period of time when millions of people were let go by the likes of IBM and GM and some of these others, and all of a sudden you've got a consultant now on every corner that's making decent money working for themselves out of their houses.
I agree. And how many, the opposite side, let me just give you a little negative and a positive with that, that if you do have this kind of breakaway from the office environment, whereas they now we're like, hey, you know what? We could work from home or we could work from a small place. You know, we set up an office in our house. How is that going to impact the corporate real estate market, you know, the office real estate market? We're starting to see a little bit of questions there as to how long that's going. WeWork is over.
Yes. I was just thinking about that myself okay, now you've got an office that, let's say a firm of some kind, the X firm, I don't care what it is. It's got 3,500 square feet of prime office space that they're paying, you know, $8,000 a month for or whatever. And now they realize, wait a minute, we don't need 3,500 square feet. We can get away with 1,100 square feet, and we've got half our staff working at home, and we just don't have to have that overhead anymore. Well, as we know, Andrew, money's fungible, all right? That savings in rent is going to be spent someplace else.
I agree with you. Listen, Dan Pila, you got to check out his books. We're going to have links to them on the show notes for episode number 656, The Small Business Tax Guide and How to Win Your Tax Audit. Appreciate all the help today.
Hey, my pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
All right, be safe. Bye-bye. So that was pretty good, right? A lot of good information there. I think that we covered, I think, every area, at least that I wanted to cover. There's probably so many more little nuances and details about this. If you want to understand more, you probably should contact your CPA. You should probably take a look at the regulations, whether it's to do with the Small Business Association, the loans, contact your bankers. They'll be helpful. Now, with that in mind, you have to realize they're slammed, right? You're not going to get an answer on some of this. Most of the banks with regard to any of the business loans have decided to do it all online, and you can't even call anybody or ask anybody anything for the most part. I mean, you can ask a few people possibly in the branch what they know about it, but they're going to push you online. That's where everything is taking place. And the SBA and the local unemployment offices and everybody dealing with this is overwhelmed. You know, you talk about 10 million people applying for unemployment insurance on the state level over the last 2 weeks. And no wonder why you can't get through to anybody. No wonder why the sites keep on crashing. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks anything other. We weren't prepared for this. It's not supposed to be prepared for this. So we have to take a deep breath for a moment and just let things as best as possible go through the queue, get in line, of course, and go through the queue and wait. That's what's going to happen, whether it's for your unemployment compensation credits or money or direct deposits or the stimulus check. But the good news is a lot of things otherwise have been postponed. So at least we get a little, little delay, just a little one. So that's good. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up right there. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope we answered a lot of questions regarding the CARES Act and gave you some information that you could actually use. If you have any questions over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button. Ask away. We're going to have some listener questions answered next week as well. So if you want to get yours into the queue, get in there now, right on the site. Thanks so much for joining me. Follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz, one word. And I will see you next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.